once more unto the breach, dear friends, else fill the wall up with our English dead. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and this is Jake McClure. I'm flying solo today. Elder Baldy is at home, as has been the case since early March, maybe late February, and the phone lines aren't working. So I may need some help. If you guys have the ability to email your questions, I'm taking email at jake@tpwc.com. That's jake@thepersonalwealthcoach.com. So I'm just going to jump right into the disclosures. What is this program? This is the Personal Wealth Coach. It's not just a radio program. The name of that program is shared with our firm, the Personal Wealth Coach. The Personal Wealth Coach as a firm offers fiduciary investment advice. It's an SEC-registered investment advisory firm. That doesn't mean that the SEC has approved or denied us. That's just our regulatory body. The radio program is not fiduciary investment advice. It's education, because the whole concept of the term investment advice requires knowledge of you. And we're in a reverse situation here. You guys have knowledge of me, and I don't have much of you, because that's the way the microphone works, I guess. It's a one-way transmission. So I'll do my best today to educate. That is our entire purpose here, is to get as much out there on why things are acting the way they are and what you can expect in the future and how you can come to those conclusions yourself rather than having someone else tell you them. It's a thought process, and hopefully we do a good job at teaching it. It is difficult sometimes. Some other things about the radio program. The firm, the Personal Wealth Coach, does not pay for the radio program. We don't pay for this. It's not paid commercial programming. We don't get paid to do it either. It's volunteer work. We do advertise on KTEM for the radio program, which I guess is our donation to say, hey, listen to this stuff. We don't do this to get business. Sometimes that happens as a byproduct, and we're very happy for that. But the vast majority of what we're doing here has no impact on our bottom line at all. So why am I doing it? Because the impact is indirect. The more you as the listener understand about the economy that we live in, the more you understand about the methodologies that different organizations go through in measuring what's happening and making predictions about things and what that's about, the better you are able to plan for yourself. And I believe in Adam Smith, the founder of capitalism, a Scotsman from the 18th century, when he said that if you improve society by allowing people the best methodology to work in their own best interest, so long as they're not interfering in the best interests of the people around them. That's capitalism as it was founded. Now, it's come to be called a lot of other things since then. It's very much considered to be a cutthroat world of dog eat dog in its more modern concepts of what capitalism is. Capitalism is originally intended to co-support businesses so that the businesses have the best opportunity to help each other while making profits. And that's pretty vital. Little piece of ancient trivia. I get all caught up on that sort of thing. I'm definitely a word nerd. Just even the concept, I was thinking about this morning. I'm going to go down this before we hit what the market is. I'm going to tell you something completely irrelevant, but we'll give you a little window into who I am. The word ball comes from the Latin word bolus, which means round. So you say, okay, the word ball means round. That's the original meaning of the word. Then you have a football. Well, you can look at a football, and at least in one cross section, it's round. Okay. But what about a hockey puck? That's cross section round as well. Not a ball. That's a puck. because language is not logical, folks. So keeping in mind that statistics are the least logical part of language is important when measuring the economy. So what's going on? This is a great example. If I had a survey to all of my listeners, which I can't do because we don't have the phone lines, but if I could, and I said, "Is the market up or down right now?" I think most people would respond that it's down, and I would agree with them. But it really depends on when we're looking from. So I'm going to jump right in. The S&P 500 is the index that we tend to report about, not because it is essentially better than the other indexes, but it's a well-known, and it's much broader than the Dow Jones Industrial Average. There's 500 companies in it instead of 30. Now, when you consider that a very large percentage is made up of five companies in the S&P 500, it makes it less apparent what the overall economy is doing. And that's the case right now. The five companies have an outsized weight in the S&P 500, and it causes weird glitches in the data. So here's an example. If I'm asking, is the market down? Okay, the S&P 500 for this week, for the 5 days of this last week, Monday through Friday, was down 1.32%. That is, by definition, down. It's down 16.23% from the top in mid-February. So just over 16% down from its peak. But it's up from the bottom by 26.8%. And you can't add 16% down and we've recovered 26. That means we were down like 42%, right? No, we were down 35%. And percentages are weird. You have to think if the market drops 50% to recover, it has to rise 100%. Okay, I haven't even gotten to the weird stuff in the statistics yet. So from the March bottom, it's up almost 27%. Year to date, so we were just saying from the top it's down 16%. Year to date, it's down 12%. But if we go back 12 months, the market is down 3.5% from what it was 12 months ago, which is like a normal week's movement. So when we look at the longer and longer time frame, the bigger and bigger picture, it shows how little our panics really matter. The emotion is very important while it's going on, but the effect of it, when you get a longer picture, a bigger time horizon, I just mixed big picture and long time horizon. So you get a bigger time horizon and a longer picture. Of what's going on in the world. You're looking at the market, we're only down 3.5% from last year at this point. And if you go back multiple years, we're actually up. So is the market down? I would agree. It is down. It's discounted. But the nature of the market is that the long-term averages are a lot more important than the short term. I think most people that listen to this program, that's totally preaching to the choir there. The yield on the 10-year US Treasury note was down 3.9 basis points. Now, I have to warn folks, what is a basis point? A basis point is 1/100th of a percent. We're measuring in decimal points on basis points. The US Treasury note crept down 3.9 basis points. That's the 10-year note, which means that it barely moved. It closed out at 0.604%. So still a little over half a percent on a return of interest for a 10-year loan to the government right now, because people are more impressed at the moment about getting their money back. Return on their investment is less important than return of their investment. The Treasury yield curve, what is that? Well, just like I was talking about a longer picture, longer time horizon. If you look at the time horizons on loans, so traditionally people look at their mortgage, they look at credit cards. Credit cards are revolving 30-day loans. So interest rates are generally pretty all over the place on those things. They're not collateralized. But you can get a 0% interest rate for short-term stuff like cars and so on. And if you go back 5 years ago to a time when people considered interest rates to be in a more, and we'll use air quotes on this, normal environment. There's not really a normal, but we'll go to what people are used to. If you went to get a 15-year mortgage, the interest rate would have been lower than a 30-year mortgage. Why? Well, because the bank has a longer period of risk. You've got 30 years to not pay back your debt versus 15 to not pay back your debt. So interest rates long term tend to be higher than interest rates short term. So if you're in a 30-year bond, you should hopefully be making more money than your checking account. Well, wait, Jake, are you mixing things up here? A checking account, that's not a loan. Unfortunately or fortunately, technically it is a loan. You're making a loan to the bank when you open a bank account. This is a weird concept, and a lot of people have trouble wrapping their minds around it. When you make a deposit in a checking account, you're making what is called a short-term revolving callable loan. You can call that bank and say, "Give me my money whenever you wish." Now, they're not going to pay you a lot of interest on that because you can call it at any point. They can't do anything with the money significant if you can just show up and take it. So if you, for instance, a mortgage is not generally callable. It's a very weird case scenario where you have a callable mortgage. There's some commercial mortgages that are like that. But most residential houses have mortgages, and most mortgages are not callable because that would be really not fun to be in the middle of your mortgage and get a call from the bank saying, "Hey, pay us all of it now." That seems really unreasonable, but that's what we expect from banks on our checking accounts. You get typically a higher interest rate on a CD because you're locking it away for a longer period of time. You're not going to touch it in the middle of that. And you traditionally will lose some of your interest or all of your interest, in some cases have a little penalty if you take it out before that time period, because the bank is going to have to go through some expense to replace that money because they've loaned it out in some kind of a longer term situation. They may have used it for a car loan. So if you give them a five, if you say, "I'm going to get a 5-year CD," they may turn around and take that 5-year CD and apply it directly to a car loan. Now, it's not generally done one to one. It's usually a pool of money in 5-year CDs, and they're used for this purpose. Well, then, if the bank can charge higher than whatever they're paying you on the CD, they make a profit. Okay, makes sense. The traditional aspect of the yield curve is that the shorter interest rates tend to be lower. And if you just think of a slope as you go down through time and the interest rates get higher and higher, you just get a kind of a straight line that's going from low to high the longer the time frame. Well, sometimes that gets weird bulges in the middle as people have, for instance, a higher demand for car loans. Well, if there's a higher demand for car loans, interest rates will go up. So though you get these weird bulges. When the demand for shorter term stuff gets so high, interest rates have to go up. So if you're putting a bunch of money in the bank and the bank has no thought that you may ever take it out, they don't have to pay you any interest on it whatsoever. You're just going to leave it here. But if there's a lot of competition between the banks and you're saying, "Hey, I got a higher interest rate over there, I'm going to move my money," then the bank you're in needs to raise its interest rate. When the demand for the money on whatever time period gets higher, interest rates go up there. A big chunk of the last 6-month time period, we were in what's called an inverted yield curve, where the short-term money had higher interest rates than the long-term money. That is historically a predictor of recession. Now, this was not the bond market somehow presciently knowing that the coronavirus was going to hit, that we had this inverted yield curve throughout this time period in the past. It was that we were already due for a slowdown in the economy. We were already at full capacity and starting to hiccup a little bit. We were starting to stumble a little bit in our growth. It was much lower than it had been after the initial tax cuts in 2017. So we were getting back to that pretty very tiny incremental growth, which means all it takes is one event to push us into a recession. Well, this particular event that starts any given recession generally isn't that big a deal. Well, we've got a little revision in this recession. There's a big deal happening. COVID-19 is a big deal. So we went from teetering at full employment, teetering at growth in the economy, though low growth, to total stop. Okay. How do we look at this as economists? How do we look at something that essentially has never happened before? There has never been a time in human history that the population of all humanity has agreed to put all of the economy on hold at the same time. We're living in extremely historic moments. This is something that the history books are going to write about, but we can't read about them in the history books yet because this is our actual life. This is his story. This is my story. This is your story. And it will eventually become history. So how do we look at this? Well, I'm going to give you a little bit of background into me again. Throughout my career, I have been the butt of jokes, a little bit of ridicule, mostly good-natured, because I have studied the effects of natural disasters, epidemics, and pandemics on the economy. And I have given that study a great deal of weight. And in conversations with my colleagues, I have said it's really important to understand this stuff. And they've always said, yeah, you're totally trivializing the world. That's never going to happen again. Now, I'm sorry that this is an I told you so moment. I'd much rather say, be the one saying I told you so to someone winning the lottery than to having a pandemic. But the reality is that this isn't the only pandemic that we will experience. There will be others, because this time period that we have, this golden era where we just didn't have very many, it's because viruses weren't mutating. Well, viruses mutate. That's what they do. And we've come close with SARS. COVID-19 has a version of the connector for SARS on it. The technical term for it is CoV-SARS-2 or SARS-CoV-2. Because the last SARS was also a coronavirus that connected to the SARS connector. If it's not this virus, it will be another. From an epidemiological perspective, I've got clients that are epidemiologists. I've studied their impact on the economy. I've read history. All we have to do is look very short distances back to see that there are a lot worse viruses that could have hit us. If it's some kind of variant, a novel variant of smallpox, or a novel variant of just about anything that we've experienced in the past, a novel version of measles would have really devastated us. The contagion range on those, on chickenpox, on measles, on smallpox is just astronomically larger. It's truly airborne. So this is me in my not so good pep talk. It could have been worse. That's not a good pep talk. Yeah, but it is to establish the point of reality. I like to not be overly optimistic about the pandemic or overly pessimistic. Let's get pragmatic. Let's get real. What are we facing? It is a low-grade viral pandemic that was infectious enough to shut down the planet. The mortality is high, but nowhere near as high as a lot of other pandemics that we've faced in the past. So what does it mean when the economy shuts down? Well, I've said this has never happened before. What has happened is localized versions of this. And they're so normal that me just saying that we've had localized versions of this, people aren't going to be able to easily identify them. Except that what happened after Katrina to New Orleans? Their economy shut down. It wasn't a choice by a person, although to some extent it was. They said evacuate. But an external event came in and shut down the economy, just like it's happened now. The same can be said about Northeasterns, the big storms in the upper northeast of the United States that traditionally come and knock out the Northeast for a couple of weeks every year. We get hurricanes through Florida every year, or nearly every year. Hope let's knock on some wood on that one. Let's hope that's not going on right in the middle of the pandemic. But the idea is there's lots of little microcosms and not so little microcosms that we can study to say what happened. Well, number one, this is something that doesn't make headlines during this time period. It's like Katrina, Florida, big hurricane, Northeastern. You see a little spike in unemployment at the national level. But if you looked locally, you see a massive spike, very much like what we're seeing across the country. Businesses shut down. So how is that recovered? How do we get back to work in a Northeastern, in an earthquake, in a hurricane? What is the outlook on that? Well, this is where the different natural disasters start to look different from each other. They have different kinds of damage. Hurricanes have different damage than earthquakes. Skyscrapers are not generally that damaged by a hurricane, but an earthquake can do some severe damage. So there's different ways of recovering from these different events. The Northeastern, a lot of snow has different damage than a hurricane and different damage than an earthquake. So you get different issues. How do you recover from them? Well, the first thing you do in these scenarios is you catalog the damage. You say, if I'm a business owner, you go into the factory or to the restaurant or whatever, and you say, what's broken? You start filing insurance claims. You start determining who you can afford to bring back to work when your business is damaged. There's infrastructural problems. That's not true in a pandemic. Not unless we get to a point where lawlessness breaks out, and that tends to be historically when the population drops by 20%. So it's really great to read the books and so on about a virus sweeping through and causing imminent lawlessness. Unless you lose 20% of the population, recovery in the old form tends to take place. So we're not experiencing that. Coming back to work from a pandemic, there's no infrastructural damage. The last recession we had was bank related, bad debt. People had debt on houses they never intended to live in, that they were calling their primary residences. They were saying maybe we'll rent them out, but they hadn't done that. They were hoping to turn around and sell them to someone else at a higher price. Well, banks were giving out loans really easily for that, and eventually they stopped getting paid, which caused the banks to not have money to loan out to other people for other business-related things that were good and profitable. So we cleaned out all this bad debt during the recession through bankruptcies, through foreclosures, through getting back and actually paying the debt. We got to a point where we finalized the problems and got most of them fixed. We put a lot of restrictions on banks to say, hey, you can't be giving loans out to people that aren't actually living in their house as a primary residence as a primary loan. You have to look through this. Mortgage brokers were a primary reason for the problem in that you had an independent broker who had no skin in the game if the loan went bad. They got a big commission. Was that a bad model? Yes. Were mortgage brokers bad? No. Some of them lied. Some people going to get loans lied, and the banks happily ignored it because it was profitable too. So we built a lot of restrictions on what banks could do, how much money they could loan out on their reserves. We have been giving them stress tests. We've been really, really good at making sure the last recession won't happen again. Or at least not for the near future, because we're good at preparing for the last disaster. So we haven't had tremendous problems in the banking world. The biggest problem that we've had are the complaints that the SBA loans have taken a long time to go out. But if you look at a normal loan process, that is not even the case. A normal loan process for a small business, it's lucky for the business if they can get a loan in 30 days. If they already have a line of credit, they can get it overnight. The SBA didn't know who a lot of these businesses were a month ago. So the SBA has actually done a really good job here. There's been confusion. There's been a lot of problem. There's been a lot of communication problems from the federal level. But the SBA has actually done a fantastic job. And there's people that haven't received their money, and there's people that have received their money. And we're tracking that. But when you consider how long the money has been available to go out, this is actually pretty speedy, particularly when you consider the amount of applications that are being received by banks right now. Okay, so now that I've done my little giving halos to the banks, you've got to tarnish them a bit. They are working in their own best interest just like everybody else. They're out to make a profit, and I certainly wouldn't want to take a loan just to take a loan. I would much rather deal with my own reserves. So what does that have to do with the pandemic? The banks are in good shape. The Federal Reserve has been doing a really good job at stepping in and giving loans to banks so that they can make loans. The interest rates that the Federal Reserve charges to the bank are much lower than the interest rates that the bank charges to its customers. So they can afford to do this. This is one of the jobs of the Federal Reserve, is to make sure that banks have money to loan out. Why am I going into that? Because coming out of any disaster, loans will be needed. To open a business, you will need to get loans, most likely. There are businesses that have a lot of reserves on hand, but when we don't know when opening date is, it's nice to know that the banking system is full of money. It is not lacking in resources to loan people to start the economy back up. Okay, so next up. If we use an earthquake situation as a comparison, there's some other correlations. So it's a pretty good analogy here. There's structural damage in earthquakes that may not be apparent when you go back to work. This is the sort of thing that takes 12 to 15 months to really get categorized and say, whoa, this is a business that we shouldn't have opened. We need to close it, because the building needs repair. Best case scenario coming out of those situations, you get everything rebuilt and then you start business. Because it's really bad for an individual business to start up, close, start up, close, start up, close, just for the same kind of mechanical issues. That's how you burn out light bulbs, by turning them on and off and on and off and on and off. Leaving them on doesn't have the kind of stress to it that the shutdown or the turn on does. So small businesses, and this is one of those areas, this is a massive experiment. On the macro level, it's very exciting. On the micro level, it's very depressing. Small businesses are volunteer. The business owner can give up. They can say, fine, I'm done. I'm throwing in the towel. Now, business owners tend to be a little bit crazy. Speaking from experience, I am one. They tend to do things that other people consider to be risky. I mean, you're not getting a paycheck from someone else except through your customers. So they tend to be stubborn. They tend to grab on and hold on, and they tend not to throw in the towel very readily. That's going to be a big thing that we're watching. How many business owners just say, I'm not going to go back into business? There's a lot of baby boomers that were already set to retire, that were considering selling the businesses that they've been running for a while. Well, they may not have that opportunity now. So the long-term impact here is different than an earthquake, but we can see the correlations. The start-stop concept is bad. So the guidelines that the president has issued, if we can stick to them, if he can stick to them, are reasonable. to slowly ramp up essential businesses and semi-essential businesses while keeping social distance, and slowly take the consideration of what can we open safely, just like an earthquake, just like a hurricane. Consider what you can open safely so that you don't have to shut it down again in the event that we get the second wave or another tremor for the earthquake. So in the event we will get a second wave and maybe a third, that you did not hear me say if there, because there's no way we won't, just like there was no way we wouldn't have gotten this when it got spread enough. There are enough people with this that we don't have the capability to vaccinate everyone. That means it's going to be out there, which means we will get a second wave. And I hear this so regularly throughout news media. If we get a second wave, or what's your consideration on the potential of a second wave? Let's just set that aside. Just make the assumption that we will have a second wave. It's not that hard an assumption to make because we haven't eradicated the virus. That's pretty common knowledge. We've done a pretty good job at flattening the curve. What is that? People talk about flattening the curve. If everybody got sick, all of us, because we're mingling around and enough people got sick all at once, so say even 5% of the population got sick at the same time, our hospital system would fail from one end of the country to the other. We wouldn't be able to deal with the patients that have other issues. We wouldn't be able to deal with the patients with coronavirus, because we're generally a healthy society, and somewhere way below 1% of us are in a hospital at any given time. Way below that. If we have 5% of the population needing to be in the hospital, a lot of extra people die. If we can say, all right, let's keep that down, that doesn't mean we don't get sick. It doesn't mean that 5% of the population doesn't get sick. It doesn't mean that greater numbers don't get sick. It means that we slow it down so that no more than the hospitals can maintain at any given moment are sick. That means that if we put less force on that top of that peak, when we say we're past the peak, well, we've lowered the peak. That means it's flattened out. We're talking big picture, longer time horizon type stuff. Exactly like the whole theme of the program so far. It's flattened down, which means the potential for all of those same sicknesses that we flattened down is still there. All you have to do is let up the pressure on the top of the peak. That's social distancing. That's having the economy shut down. If we approach this carefully, there's parts of that peak that we don't need to have pushed down. If there are factories that we can open so that people, when they sneeze, are not sneezing on each other, that's the 6-foot thing. Well, then that's probably a fairly safe environment to open up. Now we need to get hand sanitizer, we need to get masks, we got to do this correctly, but it's very much like determining what buildings are safe to work in after a hurricane or an earthquake. So damage cataloging in the infrastructure side, we need to look at the human infrastructure, the distance we keep apart, our ability to work together without being too close together. So the cubicle environment, even if everything lightens up, I don't think going back to work in a cubicle is a really good idea unless you've got a lot of space around you. And even then, you've got stuff that are hard to sanitize all around you. Easy to sanitize things are loud. They echo a lot. Hard to sanitize things are, get this, like the inside of a radio studio. Just imagine the scary stuff that's lurking in the carpeted walls in here. Think of the cubicles and the dividers of the cubicles. Those are hard to disinfect. So this is getting down to a very detailed situated orientation on what's important to consider when opening back up. If you're a small business owner, there's not a lot of advice on this. People aren't saying these are the scenarios you need to run. As a small business owner, number one thing is you want to keep people far enough apart that they are 6 feet away from each other and not walking immediately in the space that someone else held a moment before. So if you have a lot of foot traffic in your business, That's the worst case kind of situation here, because that's the kind of thing that we can't afford to open back up right now, unless we do curbside stuff, and that's taking off. Will this change the way we do business for the totality of the future? Maybe. Maybe is the best answer I can give to that, because it will for some people. Some people will change the way they do business forever, and some people won't. And I think people that ask me that question, that answer, they already know that answer. This is not some kind of brilliant economics model that I'm looking at. I'm just know people. You know people. Some people are going to change everything about their life because of COVID-19. How many as a percentage of the population would you say are going to change the way they interact with people forever if next year we don't have any threat of pandemic that we know of? And what we'll find out is in a year or two, a lot of people are going to be back to what they consider normal, and some people won't. It's very much like what happened in Asia after SARS. That's when we started seeing a lot of people wearing masks in Japan and in China. Well, masks may be a thing in our future as well. At least some people will probably continue to wear them. Because death is a pretty good disincentive. And I've got to play some commercials. I'll be back on the other side. I'm going to be checking emails during the break. I didn't want to stop my soliloquy. It looks like there's some good questions waiting out there for me. So I'll be back on the other side. If you want to send in some emails on questions, the email address is jake@tpwc.com, like the personal wealth coach. You could actually send it to jake@thepersonalwealthcoach.com. So I'll play some commercials. I'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. Counsel. And I'm back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. The email in here for questions is jake@tpwc.com. Unfortunately, the phone lines have an issue. I'm sending them to psychological therapy as we speak, but until they get their issues resolved, we are using email. And I've got a couple of questions hanging out here for me. Recovery predictions. Oh, those are always great. In the newsletter, we projected a 2 to 2.5 year for a market recovery. How does this compare to other corrections and why? Great question. All right. There's a second question that came from the same listener that says, Wall Street Journal article says the current black swan is not coronavirus, but rather the economic shutdown. My thoughts. Okay. So in our newsletter, we made the projection that said that we think that the U.S. Markets will be recovered in 2 to 2.5 years. How does this compare with other corrections and why? We're being very conservative there. If we look back to 1960, the Hong Kong flu, there's an epidemic. And that did cause localized shutdowns of the economy. If we look back to 1918 through 1920 with the Spanish flu, we can see some comparisons in the marketplace. We were measuring the market in 1960. We were measuring at least some forms of the market in 1918. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, the Dow Jones Transportation Index, they were around. So what happened during those time periods? We have the market shape, the V-shape situation there. Both of them had recessions because of it. So let me kind of hit that second question at the same time. There's a Wall Street Journal article saying that the black swan, the real black swan, is not the coronavirus, it's the shutting down of the economy. And my response to that is, that may be correct, but it's kind of like saying it wasn't the truck that broke my ribs when it hit me, it was the bumper. The shutdown didn't happen because we all decided to take a long vacation. The shutdown was directly caused by the coronavirus. We had recessions for the pandemic in 1918 and the epidemic in 1960. So how the recession happens, whether through people being too sick to go to work and getting other people sick and a higher death rate, or shutting down the economy completely? It's a good question. This is a which one is the black swan? I think the event in general is the black swan. The black swan in the case of the Great Recession was AIG. Was it AIG doing what? What about the AIG was the black swan? Well, AIG made a bunch of loans to companies that it thought had great credit, and bought insurance and sold insurance on loans that were supposed to have great credit because the credit reporting agencies said they had great credit, because the banks said they had great credit, because the mortgage broker told them that they had great credit. So which one was the black swan? Well, it's that whole chain. That whole chain of events, it's kind of like the butterfly effect. What's the black swan of Hurricane Katrina hitting New Orleans? Was it the hurricane actually hitting? Was it the butterfly flapping 3 weeks before or somewhere else on the globe that caused the first gust of wind, that, you know, and so on? The reality is you can never point at one tiny piece of a black swan. What is a black swan? Let me throw that out there too. And we've said this before. If you already know it, just bear with us. For a very long time, mathematicians in the Renaissance, very much like what we say when pigs fly today, that'd be like there's a black swan, because in Europe there were no black swans. In Asia, there were no black swans. But then Australia was discovered. And there's a lot of black swans in Australia. So black swans happen. And when you say when pigs fly, well, how do we get pork to China? They do. They just maybe didn't enjoy it as much as the concept of pigs with wings. So pigs do fly. Black swans do happen. The 2 to 2.5 year market recovery, in both of those cases that I just cited, it was a 12-month market recovery. And we're much more on track for that than the 2 to 2.5 year. It's not a prediction to say your portfolio recovery will happen or any of that. It's just a simple statement of, based on history, for events like this, what has been the traditional recovery period? And when we say 2 to 2.5 years, that's being extremely conservative. And that has a lot of variables that we are saying bad, bad, bad case scenario. Like, we don't get a vaccine that works for 18 months. That's not going to be the case. And I'm going to fill some folks in on this area too. My older brother is the CEO of a biotech company in Austin. My younger brother has been rewriting and managing the infectious disease database for Homeland Security, like the guy doing it. So I'm getting on the viral front a lot of information there. I've got clients whose specialty is infectious disease, who are epidemiologists, and I'm getting information kind of across the spectrum, from business owners and from doctors and from programmers and from people in bioengineering. And there's a lot of exciting things to talk about, but the reality is that best case scenario for a vaccine is not going to happen. The best case scenario for a functional vaccine would require ethical violations in the testing of the vaccine. So just imagine hearing about a study where they're actively infecting both the people that were injected with placebo and the people that were infected or were injected with the vaccine. Yeah, we haven't done that since World War II. We did it a little bit with radiation after World War II in the military, and it's a mark of shame on our past. Now, at the time, we thought it was eminently necessary to make sure that we understood what would happen. We could say that again today. But in the future, we may look back with 2020 hindsight and say we pushed it too far. So in a scenario like that, where people were being infected intentionally after being double-blind vaccinated. Double-blind means that the doctor doesn't know if it's a placebo or the actual vaccination, and the patient doesn't know. So will that be a scenario that we're actively infecting people with this? I sincerely, deeply, deeply doubt that we will do that. That we could do that in a 4 to 6 month time period, we could have a vaccine. But I tremendously doubt that that is something that any ethically minded scientist would want to do. Because the placebo's out there. And in order to have good test results, you have to test both sides with the same stuff. So, no, that's not going to happen. So how do we test vaccines? Well, we give them to people, and then we wait to see if they get sick. And we wait to see if anything else weird happens to them. So it's the only way we know to do it right now. We don't have a perfect human model that we can inject without ethical consequences to determine if it works yet. Our computer models are not that advanced. We don't understand enough about our own bodies. We're nowhere near understanding it from a model perspective. Now, we've made tremendous leaps forward. The vaccinations, several of them are empty virus husks. Not coronavirus, the same kind of viruses that are used for CRISPR technology when they're changing DNA. And they fill those things up with the spike protein on the outside of the coronavirus, the thing that punctures the cell walls and allows them to enter and replicate themselves using the cell, or cause the cell to replicate them. So they've taken these empty packages of viruses, which just by themselves, that's a little bit like magic. That's science fiction right there. They've taken the spike protein, which they didn't get from the virus. They made it themselves. And they stacked it in that little pouch of a virus thing and closed it all up so that it's all inside. And then that's the thing that's going to be irritating enough for our immune system to start producing antibodies against the spike protein. That's the thought. That's magic stuff. We've made huge leaps forward, but we still have to test it the old-fashioned way because we don't have a complicated enough model. Even though we can manufacture the spike protein, even though we can empty out that virus and fill it up with our own juicy goodness in the middle, we don't know the total effects yet when that's injected in someone. So it's going to take a while. So there's supply chain issues too, because while that's going on, you don't know which of these vaccines are the ones that you're going to need to mass produce. So there's different methodologies of mass producing spike protein than for mass producing a dead virus. So think about that. Supply chain issues are really the fulcrum of this entire shift. Everything that we're looking at, the concept of on-time, very fast delivery, we're getting more and more used to that. Amazon Prime doing 1 and 2 day shipping. 2 day was big. Now there's a lot of the 1 day in there. Well, up till the pandemic. So we'll talk a lot more on the shifts of the supply chain next hour. I think this is it's both macroeconomically exciting and microeconomically depressing. So there's your excitement depression sandwich, if you will, of macro and micro. Other times the micro stuff looks great and the macro stuff looks bad. And that may be the case in some of the people that are receiving the SBA loans. On the micro level, that looks great. But on the macro level, whoa, there's a lot of money going to people that don't necessarily need it. We'll have to figure out how to go forward with that because you offer free money and amazingly people take it. If you offer very few restrictions, amazingly people take it. But we're about out of time for this hour. So I'll be back for another entire hour, starting at 11, where we'll go into some issues on supply chain and what that means. What is the supply chain and talking about the history of it and how we did the transition to where we are now, what the next steps in that transition are. And that's going to be part of the answer to the other questions on recovery time, both for the market and for the economy. The market and the economy are different things, and a lot of times journalists get them very mixed up, and we'll talk about that some next hour as well. But if you would like to talk to us off the air, We have voicemail waiting locally at 254-947-1111. Or you can call toll-free 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN for those of you still with the landline. That takes you to voicemail during the weekend, but we have not shut down. We have real-life people answering phones during the week. They're doing it, in the vast majority of our staff is working remotely. And we've got folks that have been working remotely a lot longer than the pandemic. So we were pretty prepared for this. But don't be surprised if you hear kids in the background. That's all I'm saying. I think that's pretty common across the board. If you'd like to email me or Jeff, the email addresses are jake@tpwc.com or jeff@tpwc.com. You can go to the webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com. We've got research, newsletters going back a long time. We've got recordings of the radio program going back a long time. I recommend people hold us to what we said before, and we've had some people do it. I appreciate that. We're not always right. We like being right, and we're right more often than wrong, I think. If you would like, please stay and listen to the next hour. And thank you for listening. This has been the Personal Wealth Coach, and now we're going to stop.